From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Matt Taibbi says if you're going to understand the real context for the Eric Garner story, that's the man who died when a police officer put him in a chokehold in New York. If you're going to understand that story, he says, you've got to understand the other side of American justice, where not one high-ranking executive from any financial institution caught up in the collapse of 2008 went to jail. Not one. In his book, Taibbi explores this question, just who does go to jail in this country and why? Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about his book. He says something is at work to explain all this, something that cuts deep into the American psyche. Basically, it's this, our hatred of the poor and our reverence for the rich. His book is called The Divide. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book called The Divide, the journalist Matt Taibbi explores the growing gap in America's justice system. In it, he uses stories, vignettes, to illustrate these two conflicting trends in this country, growing wealth inequality and mass prison incarceration. At its most fundamental level, though, Taibbi is asking this question, who goes to jail in this country and why? Why do the hyper-wealthy go unpunished, in particular for their behavior, for example, during the financial collapse in 2008? And yet, why, at the same time, has the prison population for low-income Americans exploded? Taibbi sees all of this as a complicated evolutionary process where, he says, the rule of law has come to be replaced by massive bureaucracies designed to criminalize failure and weakness and immunize success and strength. The book is called The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. He's the author of six books, including Griftopia. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. And Matt Taibbi, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I wanted to begin, and you've talked about this before, but I wanted you to sort of set this up that I guess it was maybe 10 years ago or so you started covering white-collar corruption. And in fact, I've heard you say that you have this kind of dark, perverse affection for the subject in a kind of a dark way. You want to start with that? Mm-hmm. What is your affection for all of this?
Actually, it's funny. I think it goes back even farther than that because I lived in the former Soviet Union for almost 10 years. Yeah. Actually, the first, I got out of college in 1991. I finished school over there in what was then Leningrad. And I lived in Russia until 2002. Working mostly as a journalist during that time. And, the Russians, among other things, they have a lot of talents for various things, including chess and track and field, but also organized crime and white-collar crime. And that was one of the things that I covered quite a lot over there were corruption schemes, embezzlement, all these crazy theft stories that emanated from these oligarchical figures. So I spent a lot of time on that stuff, and I was always fascinated by the different machinations that these crooks use to funnel money out of the country. And then when I came back to the States, I really didn't cover that kind of thing for a long time. I spent a lot of time on the campaign trail, mm-hmm. which is very superficial kind of a story. You spend a lot of time listening to the same speeches over and over again and the same talking points. And it wasn't until 2008 that I really got put back on this, very complicated, difficult to figure out corruption story again. And it was very familiar to me. A lot of the themes were very much the same as what I'd covered over in Russia.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I was fascinated by the different clever ways that figures on Wall Street had used to siphon money out of the population.
You write about how when you were in Soviet Russia that you noticed basically how the system worked, that there were these two sets of laws. You had the written ones and then you had the unwritten ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess in some way the reason you started writing this particular book about this place is you were seeing the same kind of thing playing out, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the most striking things that I first noticed when I went over there to study way back in 1990. It was still the Soviet Union back then. And, everybody that I met was using what they call hard currency. You know, they were trading dollars for rubles or they were buying things in the black market. But the police would only hassle a certain cast of characters who were breaking those laws. They had these people called farsovshiki who would show up at the university where I studied, and those guys, they were like the equivalent of street-level drug dealers here in America. That's what the police did. That's how they racked up their statistics. They brought these guys in five or six times a week, and they got their stats. And meanwhile, the rest of the country who was engaging in these same activities, they were all trading money. They were all buying in the black market. The police left them alone. So it was a situation where everybody was breaking the law, but the police got to selectively enforce the law and they'd decide who to arrest and who not to arrest. And I think our drug laws are, for instance, are very similar to that. I mean, if you look at the statistics, there's really no difference in the amount of the frequency of drug abuse between one race and another. But the people who are criminally prosecuted for that kind of offense is very heavily tilted towards the non-white and especially the poor population.
But you write this. This is so interesting. You say that in Soviet Russia, one thing you noticed was that the instant people, and I'm quoting you here, the instant people were permitted to think about all of this and question mm-hmm. the unwritten rules out loud, it was like the whole country woke up from a dream and the system fell apart in a matter of months. So you have the Soviet Union sort of, at least at that point, going in one direction where everyone was starting to question that. But you say what's going on here in this country is kind of the reverse of that. Is that right?
It seems to me. I mean, I know how crazy that sounds, but I was there when the Russian people suddenly started thinking about this stuff, and it was funny because for decades it was just taken for granted that a certain kind of person was a target for the police and the authorities, and another sort of person was never to be touched and never to be questioned. And if that kind of person got in trouble in any way, it was dealt with, in a non-criminal fashion. And people just unquestioningly accepted that system. That's just the way it was. The actual laws were a joke that nobody really listened to. The important rules were the ones that were unwritten, that everybody understood, and they understood the finest gradations of those rules. You know, what kind of person was allowed to do what, where you were allowed to buy certain kinds of black market goods, what kinds of things you could say in the workplace. But the moment people were able to talk out loud about how this system was crazy and unfair, and the whole edifice of the entire country collapsed, and I was there, I watched it happen, and it seems to me that in this country we're developing kind of an opposite instinct where, let's say you have a case like HSBC, which is a bank that got caught laundering over $800 million for a pair of Central and South American
drug cartels.
Yeah. And this is as serious a crime as bankers can commit, right? They're essentially aiding and abetting the most violent criminals on earth. One of the cartels, the Sinaloa cartel, suspected in over 20,000 murders. So you're talking about the worst things that bankers can do, and nobody was prosecuted. Nobody did a day in jail. The company was let off with a fine, and yet there was no outrageous response in this country because we think of that sort of offender as not being the kind of person who goes to jail,
and or,
in fact,
deserves
when I talk to prosecutors,
right?
or deserves it. I talked to prosecutors about this, and some of them kind of off the record, you know, or not off the record exactly, but on background, what they would say to me are things like, well, these aren't crimes, or you know, have you been to a jail? Jails are dangerous. I mean, as though it's only okay for a certain people kind of person to go to a dangerous jail. It's a weird thing. It's a psychological thing more than anything else.
See, a lot of your book is about that, too, is about this, which I want to dig into. That is that profound sort of transformation of psyche. And the interesting part of this is that, and here's how you put it in the book, we all get it. Mm-hmm. So explain what you mean, because you say we're all making these silent calculations about, as you put it, who's entitled to what, to particular rights and who is not. Would you talk about how we all kind of get it and how we all make these calculations?
Well, sure. I mean, let's take the Eric Garner case that just happened here in Staten Island.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a situation where there's a guy who has a criminal record. He's been arrested, I believe it's 30 times, but he's essentially standing peaceably on a street corner. He was, according to the police, selling untaxed single cigarettes. So this is as petty crime can possibly get, right? I mean, this is somebody selling a 75-cent cigarette, and yet he's surrounded by six police officers. When they confront him and tell him they want to arrest him, he, you know, gives them a little bit of, you know, attitude about it, and he's tackled and he dies. And when you talk to people about this, there isn't this surprise that this kind of person would be surrounded by six police and arrested for such a minor crime, because we get it, because we get the police. That's what police do. They surround African-American men who stand on street corners and do things that are against the law. Whereas if you want to talk about a company like, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase, which has been paying billions of dollars in regulatory fees, fines, and penalties, and you suggest that somebody should go to jail for frauds in the hundreds of millions of dollars, people scratch their heads and they look at you like, well, no, I mean, why not just do it this way? I mean, who, you know, who's hurt by collecting billions of dollars in penalties? And it's just, we make these calculations. You know, Eric Garner sold a 75-cent cigarette, but he's the kind of person who goes to jail, whereas a person who works at a big, too-big-to-fail bank and defrauds pension funds out of hundreds of millions of dollars, his company pays a fine, and he doesn't go to jail. And it's we don't talk about it, but we all get it.
Has it surprised you at all how your book almost seems more relevant today than it did in the spring when it first came out?
Yes and no. I mean, I obviously I didn't see Ferguson coming.
Sure.
I mean, but I think, you know, having, let me just back up and talk about how I started to write this book. I mean, I had been covering Wall Street for quite a long time, and that was the side of society that I was really focused on. And I had been covering these corruption scandals. They had the same ending every time. Nobody gets indicted. Nobody goes to jail. So I had to learn about, you know, in order to understand how ridiculous that was, I felt like I needed to understand who does go to jail and why. And so when I started to learn about how policing works in inner cities in America, you know, the stuff I found out was so bizarre and so counterintuitive and crazy that let's put it this way, when Ferguson happened, I wasn't surprised that it happened, because if you start to get pulled over 40 and 50 times over a couple of years for the tiniest little offenses, which is the way our quality of life policing works, and what happened to somebody like Eric Garner, eventually someone's going to blow up and they're going to behave badly with one of those police confrontations, and you're going to get something like what happened. And looking back, I would say that the things that are going on now and the anger that we're seeing, I think it's inevitable. I mean, it was always inevitable.
There's a story you tell right up front in the book that I wanted you to go through, because it's, in some way, it's a very simple kind of story, but kind of profound, I found. And it's this Vietnamese refugee woman. You went to San Diego to do research for the book. And you write this in the book. You say tell the story, because it's such a kind of a simple story, but it seems to kind of convey the bigger theme in your book in many ways.
Yeah, so San Diego, which I should point out, is unique among all the counties in the country. They have this program that I haven't found an analogous program. Let's put it that way. They have a program called the P100 program, in which people who are applying for public assistance, you know, for the TANF program, what we used to call welfare, cash assistance, they have to be preemptively searched by the city or by the state. And what the state is looking for is fraud in the welfare application. So typically what that means is it's a single mother who's applying for welfare, and the government wants to know and make sure that she's not cohabitating with a man who is actually paying the bills. So what they do is they show up at the house, and they don't tell you when exactly they're coming. And they come into the house and they go through all your things looking for evidence, you know, possibly that a man is living in the house. And then I've talked to a number of different people who told similar stories. But one was with a lawyer who had represented this Vietnamese refugee. And the inspector comes bursting into the house and goes straight to her bedroom, opens up her underwear drawer, uses the eraser end of a pencil to start picking up the individual, you know, items of lingerie, and he holds up a pair of Victoria's Secret panties in this accusing fashion and looks at her and says, you know, who are these for? In other words, if you don't have a boyfriend, why do you have sexy underwear? And the woman, incidentally, was a rape victim she was a refugee back in Vietnam. And, wow. And she comes to this country and it's so humiliating and so traumatizing. But the attitude, I mean, I heard so many stories that were like this, where the people are contemptuous before they even come in through the door. And look, having that job, I'm sure you see a lot that might make you a little bit contemptuous. But still, there's this attitude that people who need money and can't take care of themselves and are down on their luck, they're already guilty before they've even been actually caught committing a crime. There's this attitude that they're a drag on the rest of us, and that, you know, whether or not they've been legally caught yet of committing a crime, they're already metaphorically guilty. And I thought that incident summed that up.
One thing we should point out, as you do in the book, is that perspective is really critical here, because you say people may understand this on some level, but it's hard to understand how bad it has gotten because we all live on one side of the equation. And I guess that's the point of the book, right, is that we all have our perspective. We get it ensconced as we are in our own sort of cultural place. The point in writing that book was to say it's all about perspective, and in order for you to understand one side of this, you've got to see the other side of it.
Yeah, I thought that was really for me an interesting part of this whole issue, is that it's not just that your ordinary middle class white family that doesn't live in an inner city has no idea what it's like to be routinely stopped and searched in a program like Stop and Frisk if you live in a neighborhood like Bedford-Stuyvesant or the South Bronx, and no idea how infuriating and frustrating that can be, and no idea where the anger is coming from. It also goes the other way. It's people who, you know, inner city, poor non-white people who've been living with this kind of stuff for years and years and years, they have no idea the levels of impunity that white collar criminals enjoy at the very upper reaches of society. They're completely blind to that as well. So there's this gulf of understanding on both sides of the equation, where neither side really understands how extreme the situation has got. And that's sort of what I was trying to do with this book, was to show stories from both sides, so that a person who was either in one place or another could see both sides simultaneously and see how you know, vast that difference between how we treat people on one end and how we treat people on the other end has gotten.
It's a kind of a new approach for you in some ways. I mean, a lot of people have kind of have pointed that out, that, and you even say in the book that you're not really arguing a point as much as just laying out these vignettes, these stories, because as you put it, the story speaks for itself.
Yeah, I think if you try to take a if you stand in a soapbox and scream about how crazy it is, it's actually less effective than just showing all of these stories. Yeah. And so that's what I really tried to do. I tried to find stories that were representative, and then just report them as much as I could, and then juxtapose them against each other. And I thought that was the best way to get at this. For instance, looking back now, I told the story of a guy in Bedford-Stuyvesant named Andrew Brown, who's a bus driver who keeps getting arrested for this little crime called obstructing pedestrian traffic. Yeah. Basically he's standing in a place where the police don't like. It turns out that that's exactly the offense that the Ferguson police officers first decided to, that flagged them to Michael Brown. And so that's what I was trying to do with the story, is take these typical stories and show people in great detail how they work.
I want to get back to Andrew Brown because I want you to sort of really lay this story out, because it talks about how it seems like with the Eric Garner story, if you look at that, because you've recently talked about the fact that one high profile moment, and everyone has seen the images in the video, that there were a lot of other things that led up to that, these bureaucratic calculations that play into that. That's really what your book is about, and I want to get to some of those stories when we get back from a break. Matt Taibbi is with us. His book is called The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Matt Taibbi. We're talking about his book called The Divide, which came out in the spring, but stories like Ferguson, Missouri, Eric Garner in New York have really brought his point to life. Taibbi's reporting has led him to this idea that the rich and the poor in this country are subject to vastly different measures of justice. He's joining us to talk about it. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. So in the book, Matt Taibbi, early on you point out what you describe as this bizarre statistical mystery that the country has fallen into. Three pieces of information that don't really fit. And I wanted you to go through that because I think it's important context for your story.
Yeah, and I had no idea about this when I started writing the book, but the stats are that violent crime has been dropping precipitously since the early 90s, and criminologists don't really have a clear understanding of why. There are a variety of explanations, but it has been dropping over about 100% fewer crimes per 100,000 than there were back in, say, 1991, according to FBI statistics. During that same period, the prison population has more than doubled in this country, and we've also seen real incomes decline rather steadily over the course of two decades. So none of these pieces of information really fit, because you would expect as people have less money and jobs become scarcer, that you would actually expect a rise in crime, but that hasn't happened. A rise in violent crime, that is.
Right.
And as crime decreases, you would expect the prison population to also decrease, but that hasn't happened. So all of these numbers are very paradoxical. To me, what it speaks to is that we have increased our instinct to put people in jail, a certain kind of person in jail. We've gone the criminal route with certain kinds of behavior much more often than we did previously. And beyond that, it's just a strange thing. Politically, clearly there's something going on in this country.
It's interesting that you don't just peg it to racism. It seems like in some way it's maybe more a class thing almost, or Well, here's what I wanted you to get at, and I mentioned this earlier, that you say something is at work, something else is at work. It's not just about the fact that rich guys can pay for legal representation and poor guys can't. And this is the sort of more disturbing thing. You found that, and it's one of the major themes in the book, that we have, and this is how you put it, a profound hatred of the weak and the poor. Is that it, you think? I mean, if you were to sort of distill it down, that's a big part of all of this.
I think so. You don't want to extrapolate too much,
sure.
But clearly I think, and a lot of this is just from my own anecdotal observations. I spent a lot of time in courtrooms in the last 2 or 3 years doing research for this book.
Yeah.
And for instance, one of the things that I noticed was that in the white collar cases, for instance, in some high-level lawsuits that I watched, and also a couple of criminal trials, there aren't many of them, but I watched a couple of them, the judges are extremely deferential to defense counsel in those cases. They're often dealing with people with whom they went to school, or they went to the same colleges as the defense counsel. They're the same class of person. So they're interested in hearing those arguments. And it's not that they're sympathetic with the defendants necessarily, but they're the same kind of person. So they hear out those the arguments on the other side. Whereas in city courts, when you're dealing with low-level offenses like prostitution or simple assault or even something as ridiculous as public urination or carrying an open container of alcohol, you're almost always dealing with a judge who doesn't live in the same community as the people he's judging, he or she is judging, and they're very short with the defense counsel. They have absolutely no patience whatsoever for the defendants, and there's this anger that pervades the entire process that you just don't see in those other cases. The other cases are these intellectual battles of wits where the judge is respectful to both sides, and it's just not the same in criminal court. You feel that. And I think it's borne out in our politics where, Mitt Romney's comment about the 47% rings true with people. They just feel that people who don't have money are somehow parasites who are leeching off the rest of the country. And conversely, people who are very successful, well, they must have done something right to have made that much money. And I think that's part of this equation.
Well, you write in the book, we're building a bureaucracy to match those two tendencies. So I wanted to get to some of those infrastructure mechanisms, really, that are in place. And I guess we should maybe start with Eric Holder, because this is an important part of these, as you call them, extra-democratic mechanisms that affect the system. Tell us about Eric Holder's collateral consequences plan, because it's an important part of the story.
Yeah, this is a crazy little detail, but when Holder was an assistant attorney general in the Clinton administration in the waning days of Clinton's presidency in 1999, he was sort of a little-known lawyer in Washington who authored a memo that came to be called the Holder Memo.
Right.
And in it, it was actually kind of a get-tough-on-crime memo. It gave prosecutors a lot of tools to go after corporate criminals. But at the end of it, he outlined this policy called collateral consequences, in which basically the idea was, it said, if you're a prosecutor and you're worried about the consequences to innocent victims of a prosecution, like the shareholders or the people in the community where the corporation might be based, or executives who weren't guilty of the wrongdoing, you may consider non-penal remedies. And 10 years later, when he returned as Attorney General, collateral consequences essentially became the official policy of the United States government. They invoked that same rationale to not press forward with criminal charges against companies like HSBC, against UBS for its role in the LIBOR scandal, which was an extremely serious scandal involving the manipulation of world interest rates. They brought it up over and over and over again, and that's why we haven't seen these prosecutions. They've gone for fines and deferred prosecutions instead.
This is I wanted to ask you about this the collapse of Lehman Brothers Investment Bank. Is it, this is another thing that you write about. Where does that fit? Which you describe it as a sweeping two-act crime drama that really took over the American law enforcement and American imagination, too, on some level. So put this story in context of that as well, if you would.
Sure. I got a call from a lawyer who used to work for Lehman, and this was about, I would say, 6 months after the crash. And we were talking about something totally unrelated about one of the executives at the company and how this person may have evaded taxes. And he sort of offhandedly mentioned, oh, and by the way, they just pulled off the biggest bank robbery in history and nobody even batted an eye about it. And I asked him what he was talking about. And he outlined this very elaborate story, which is extremely interesting, which was that when Lehman Brothers went into collapse, a number of its executives moved quietly, arranged to move to Barclays, which was a bank that would eventually buy Lehman Brothers. Yet while they were still at Lehman, these same executives were in charge of valuating the company for its eventual sale to Barclays. And what they did is they marked the company down. Depending on who's doing the counting, it was the discount was somewhere between $5 and $13 billion. And then they subsequently moved to Barclays and got extremely lucrative jobs. I think the total was over $300 million in bonuses for a small handful of executives. So this is, according to some lawyers that I spoke to, this is an extremely similar thing to a crime that you used to see in small towns called fraudulent conveyance, where you'd have somebody would, a person would come into a town, open up a store, buy a bunch of goods on credit, and then sell them and then split town without paying the bill. And this is sort of what happened with Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers essentially gorged itself on leverage. And all of its executives then sold the company and moved somewhere else and flew the coop, and nobody ever got busted for it. There wasn't even a criminal investigation. There was, and all there really was a kind of a lawsuit by Lehman's creditors, and that failed. So this is potentially a $13 billion heist that nobody even ever heard of, and that's not terribly uncommon in this environment. You just have these massive crimes of scale that go unreported.
You point out something that that President Obama said, which he kind of reflects the bigger cultural perspective, I guess, and that is that what happened for a lot of these executives or people making decisions that led up to the collapse of 2008 may have been unethical, but it wasn't illegal. At least which I suppose is technically true. But you say this really what the president was saying expresses part of the problem.
Yeah, if you actually look at his actual words, and I don't have them in front of me, but you can tell that Barack Obama is a lawyer and a good one by the way he phrased it, because I think what he said was some of the worst behaviors on Wall Street weren't illegal, which is true. Some of them were just merely unethical and greedy, but some of them certainly were illegal, and some of them were criminally illegal. And yet that idea that what happened in 2008 was the result of greed and not crime is pervasive. And Wall Street has been extremely successful in propagating this idea that the causes of the crash had nothing to do with for instance, the mass criminal fraudulent sale of toxic mortgage-backed securities, but instead was simply a case of a bunch of banks overestimating the value of their mortgage holdings and getting too worked up about a real estate speculative bubble, and that was what caused the problem. In fact, it was really a simple case of fraud, except executed on a mass scale. And then, of course, we move on to even more serious and more overtly criminal behaviors, like the HSBC case, like the LIBOR case, like Jefferson County, Alabama. I mean, there's one after the other. There's the manipulation of the foreign exchange market, which we're seeing now. These are crimes. These are like organized crimes, and yet most people don't understand that.
So we have that on one side. You tell this part. And then there's that, again, that counter view, which leads us kind of back to the street. And Andrew Brown, there are a lot of stories like Andrew Brown's in the book, but I want to focus us on his when we get back from a break. Matt Taibbi is with us. His book is called The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. And we'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Matt Taibbi. We're talking about his book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. All right, so let's talk about Andrew Brown, whom, as you point out in the book, he wanted to be a cop when he was a kid.
He did. He was really into the show Chips as a kid. You know, he always, when they played cops and robbers, he liked to be the cop when he was a little kid. But that shortly thereafter changed. I met Andrew. I was in the waiting room for a lawyer's office. I was waiting to talk about a completely different case, and I just met this guy sitting next to me. He was then a 35-year-old African-American bus driver, and I asked him what he was doing there, and he said, "Oh, I got busted for obstructing pedestrian traffic." And, you know, like most white people in New York, I didn't know what that was. Yeah. And he explained to me that he had just gotten finished driving a shift, driving a shuttle bus for a casino. He gets home. It's 1 o'clock in the morning.
Let's underline that. It's 1 o'clock in the morning.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning. The streets are completely empty,
yeah.
Except he sees a friend of his coming out of the build of his project tower. The two of them stop, and Andrew wants to have the guy listen to a song that he wrote. So they plug into an MP3 player. They're listening on headphones. The police think they're doing a drug deal, so they show up around the corner and they ask these guys for ID. And here's where the sort of community policing backstory comes into play,
yeah.
Because Andrew had already been through this kind of thing so many times,
yeah.
That he refused to give ID. He told them that they didn't have any cause to stop him.
This is where this starts sounding a lot like the Eric Garner story, right? Because
I mean,
enough is enough, and that refrain, I can't even remember what it is offhand. Oh, this stops today.
This stops today.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, Andrew, I can't even tell you how many incidents he had. If I had to count them off the top of my head, and let me back up and say Andrew had a real criminal history.
Sure.
Like, you know, not going to sugarcoat it, when he was in his late teens and early 20s, he did some serious time for some serious crimes. And, you know, but for a few incidents, he could still be in jail today. But he got out and he turned his life around. He got married. He got a square job. He's got three kids. He's, you know, the sweetest guy now. But for the last 10 years or so, he's been living in Bed-Stuy, and he keeps getting into these incidents where he's walking his dog and the police hassle him. He's walking on the way home. You know, cops don't like the look of him. They bounce his head off the roof of a squad car. His $50 leather Yankee hat falls in a puddle. He loses that. I mean, there's like dozens of these incidents over a period of about 10 years. And this last one, you know, the police are telling him that they're going to pull him in for obstructing pedestrian traffic on an empty street at 1 a.m. And he's yelling at them, you know, I'm coming home from work, and he's holding his tie. He's like, look, I'm wearing a tie. Mm. And that didn't matter. They pulled him in. They took him to the station. They strip searched him. And they gave him a summons. And Andrew shows me the summons in the lawyer's office. And sure enough, it reads, you know, obstructing pedestrian traffic at the bottom, which is part of the disorderly conduct law, which I find out is a very commonly used, you know, it's a summons that you see quite a lot of, and not just in New York, but in many cities that have that use these tactics. And that just led me to this whole backstory. And you're absolutely right. Andrew Brown's story is so similar to the Garner story in that, you know, by itself, if it only happened once, an ordinary person might be mad but wouldn't lose, you know, his or her, you know, self-control over it.
Yeah.
But if it's the 30th or 40th time that this has happened, it's just too much. People they cannot take it past a certain point. And I saw, you know, Andrew was a good-natured guy, but he going through this process that he had to go through to get this case dismissed, which involved a court hearing, which was so preposterous. You just can't, an ordinary middle-class white person just cannot imagine what that is like. It's just unbelievable.
Well, you were good enough not to name his lawyer, his court-appointed lawyer. You call him Waldorf in the book. And you have to say something about that exchange between Waldorf, between his attorney, and because that almost is the most telling circumstance. I mean, you've got basically New York hires this, you know, these private attorneys to defend some of these low-income people in court. Andrew fits that bill. So this exchange between Andrew Brown and Waldorf, his lawyer, really is telling because Andrew says to his lawyer is like, look, the fine's $25, big deal. Let's get out of here. Just pay this thing. But it was such a principal thing for him. He refused to do it. He wasn't going to do it.
Yeah. So I went to Andrew to court over this thing, and originally the judges, he says he's the lawyer who's this older guy. There were two of these lawyers in court, and I nicknamed them Statler and Waldorf after the guys in the Muppet Show. So Waldorf is representing Andrew, and he pulls him out into the hallway, and he says, well, we can make this whole thing go away for $50.
$50, okay.
And Andrew says, I'm not guilty. I'm not going to pay, right? Mm-hmm. And so he goes back in. He talks to the judge, and he comes back out with this big smile on his face saying, all right, the judge had knocked it down to 25. And Andrew's shaking his head. He's angrier now. He's like, you don't understand. I'm not going to pay a single dollar for standing in front of my own house. That's not a crime. And the guy literally couldn't understand it. I mean, it took us, you know, he called me in at this point to try to translate for him, basically.
Yeah.
I talked to him. He didn't get it. And eventually, when he found out that I was a journalist and I was writing a book about this, he panicked. He's like, what would possibly interest you about this scene? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, do you think this happens in white neighborhoods? Do you think people are arrested in white neighborhoods for obstructing pedestrian traffic? And he says, well, but low-class people do low-class things.
Yeah.
I just thought that was like a crucial moment because that just said everything about the attitude, like of course we arrest these people because they're the ones who are doing the crime. They're the ones who are the problem. And that, of course, we don't do this in white neighborhoods because we're not low class people. And that's the rationale right there.
I guess we should point out the judge uses a little bit of common sense and just says, he asks the basic question, was there any traffic? Was he literally obstructing traffic? He wasn't,
yeah,
so he dismisses the case.
He did. It's funny. And the arresting officers, it was really funny. They tried to deflect the question twice. They said, well, he was being difficult and he was talking back. And the judge is like, yeah, I heard that. But, you know, was there actually anybody on the street? And finally, they kind of hung their heads and one of them said, no, there was nobody else on the street. And at that point, I'm wondering, well, why aren't these guys up on charges, you know, for making up a charge on somebody? Or isn't there some kind of consequence for this? But they just made it go away. But it still took this Herculean effort, you know, to get over his own defense attorney, the judge, the arresting officers, everybody just to get out of this charge. And this is one of hundreds of thousands of incidents like this. There are about 500,000 summonses of the extremely minor variety that get written every year in New York, and a lot of them are stories like this.
Well, and it gets to this larger point. Again, these big bureaucratic mechanisms that finally lead to these points where you have Erica Garner and Andrew Brown saying, I'm done with this. I'm not doing this anymore. Because that's a big part of what the book is about. A lot of this is about, at least in this particular case with Andrew, about the stop and frisk policy. And you go back and you talk about Bill Bratton, who was the commissioner for a time, the police commissioner under Rudy Giuliani, and then Harold Safir. I mean, it's really a complicated kind of process that gets us to that moment where they don't want to take it anymore. But you describe it, I guess here's the kind of metaphor for it, as kind of a commercial fishing expedition. The police behaving like commercial fishermen, throwing nets over an entire city blocks. You want to say something about that?
Sure, yeah. No, I think this is really interesting. And also, I should point out that description came from a police officer, believe it or not. I talked to a lot of police who hate this modern system of policing that we do in inner cities, because the traditional way that they dealt with crime was they reacted to crimes, right? So somebody would steal something and the police would go chase the person, or somebody, you know, there would be something more complicated and you'd have to actually detect and interview suspects and get to know the people in the community and develop sources. Now what they do is something totally different. The so-called quality of life or broken windows style policing, what they do is they haul in anybody and everybody who does the most minor thing possible. And what they're really looking for are guns or warrants. So it's guns or fugitives are the goal. They're trying to get as many guns as possible off the street. So they bring in everybody. If you jump a turnstile, if you're riding a bike down the sidewalk, if you're obstructing pedestrian traffic, whatever it is, they bring you in, and the idea is they throw you back if you're not serious, or if you haven't actually done anything seriously wrong. But it accomplishes two things in the process. One is that they get all this intelligence about who's hanging out with who, because they're asking for IDs every time. That's why Andrew didn't want to give an ID. Mm-hmm. And they're also making people like incredibly, incredibly angry because they have to deal with being, you know, hauled into the net every couple of weeks and tossed back. And it works. You know, I think there's an argument that this kind of policing works. It does decrease crime in a way, maybe, because it provides a disincentive to carry a weapon on the street. But it sure has some other consequences, too.
What do you get? We have a caller here, and I'm guessing you hear this from time to time, Mike, who was a former police officer, who says, look, a lot of these policies protect us as law enforcement officials. How do you respond to that idea that it's dangerous out there and that the police officers who were reacting to Eric Garner, or in the case, you know, Michael Brown, that they themselves were reacting to these bigger sort of systemic things that may not have been particular to the moment, but bigger? Generally,
well, there's two things I would say to that. One is I totally respect how dangerous this job is. I've spent a lot of time with police officers. I've been out in shifts with them. I spent a lot of time last year in Camden, New Jersey, which is one of the toughest cities in America, going out with police. And look, it's a dangerous, difficult, dirty job where you're dealing with people who are high on meth or, you know, whatever it is, and they got needles in their pockets. It's a tough job. There's no way to understate how difficult it is. But the problem is, I think this policy does a disservice to police officers because it makes so many of the interactions with the subject population confrontational. You know, in the old days, the beat cop actually knew people in the neighborhood. And Andrew, you know, and some other people that I talked to all talked about this, that when they were kids, they knew the cops who patrolled their neighborhoods, and sometimes they almost played like a parental role for young people growing up. That's not the case now. Now everybody, the cops are the enemy. The cops are the people who bang your head against the wall, who stop you and frisk you and search you. And I think it makes things more dangerous for policemen. I mean, I've heard arguments on both sides. I respect them, but I think it makes it more heated.
There's a one thing that you wrote recently about the Eric Garner story is that you say that the police now have a legitimacy problem in this country, which is something you say in the book, that if the law is applied unequally long enough, over a long enough period of time, at some point law enforcement becomes politically illegitimate. Are we getting to that point, do you think?
Yeah, I think so, unfortunately. And I can't stress enough that I don't think this is really the fault of police officers.
Right.
I think this is really, it's analogous to the situation with soldiers in an unjust war, right? Mm-hmm. You think about what happened in the financial crisis. You had this enormous amount of criminal activity, and there were literally no police on the beat in many cases. Financial police. A company like AIG, there were people in that company who were doing all kinds of unethical and possibly criminal things, and yet they were regulated by an agency that had only one insurance expert on the staff. So you have the largest companies in the world, and there's one person looking at the entire tableau, and yet you have city blocks where there are dozens of police officers, watching people at all times. That is an unbelievably unequal allocation of resources, and people notice it. And it's not an accident that there are 2.whatever million people in jail in this country, and basically none of them are high-level financial criminals who are responsible for our current troubles, and almost all of them are urban and particularly non-white poor people. And people are going to notice, and they're going to stop obeying police orders sooner or later. And I think that time is coming, unfortunately.
Let me ask you this finally. I'm wondering what you're seeing there. You've been covering the response to what's going on in that Eric Garner case. Earlier, we had talked about when you were living in the Soviet Union, that people, once they were permitted to question that unwritten rule out loud, the system started to fall apart. Are you seeing some elements of that people may be starting to question all of this now?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I think what's interesting, I went to some of the protests here in New York this weekend. There were about 50,000 people who marched. First of all, what's interesting is that the suddenly you're seeing a lot of what I would say middle class or urban professional white people are suddenly turning out in big numbers at these protests. Were earlier with the Ferguson protests, I don't think the numbers were it wasn't quite as diverse. So I think the Garner case. Because the video is so unequivocal about where the blame was, I think it's touching a lot more of a general demographic, and this is also in a time when there's a lot of political apathy among young people. This is striking a chord with young people, and maybe we're getting to that point.
Matt Taibbi, his book is called "The Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap." Joined us from the studios of NPR New York City. Matt, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.